This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
This paper, I think, is a little bit different because I think a fair description would be that this is a paper about unemployment and substance abuse. But I come at it from a particular angle. Previously, I've published a set of mainly ethnographic pieces about the Western Islanders' outstation homelands milieu and the types of value that inform it. Broadly, my discussions have concerned relatedness, authority, service and circulation, the kinship in political economy and the forms of value conflict created when that kinship is juxtaposed with a cash and commodity world and the impersonalism of workplace relations. In a sense, my analyses were attempts to explain dependency in other terms. The proposal that youth, for instance, are dependent both on the state and on relatives, overdetermined for dependency perhaps, I saw as a circumstance of value conflict. The conflict I have in mind is sustained by the underlying fact that there is no hunter-gatherer economy now, at least in Central Australia, and no strongly integrated market society of the type produced by finance capitalism. In short, and in simpler terms, the job range in Central Australia is both narrow and shallow. Previous neo-colonial regimes, such as missions, cloistered Aboriginal people on the margin, and communities like Hermannsburg, henceforth in Daria, remain marginal within a now impersonal bureaucratic order. I use the term marginal here quite deliberately. I think it is appropriate because the form of market value that informs Western Aranda experience is very powerful. These values intervene in and disorganise the orientation to a bounded, local and specifically Indigenous world. Western Aranda are encapsulated but also marginalised. As a result, people bump along but not in a pleasant way. To borrow a term from Peterson, although I'm using it a little bit differently, there is confusion, in fact, about life projects. People are bored, but this is because it's hard to get a grip on what one's supposed to do. I've used the term career narrative to describe a life project common in market society. Living life less personally and in terms of what one does, as much as in terms of one's relatedness. Moreover, I've also proposed that this project is only real for some people at Indaria. I now state categorically that among Western Aranda, this is not always a felicitous life. The condition in which a large number of people are unemployed a lot of the time and the old ritual way is largely gone brings status into disarray. As a consequence, intergenerational authority relations deteriorate. In terms of coherence and constructiveness, the quality of life declines. I can think of some alternative scenarios. In northeastern Arnhem Land, perhaps, where ceremony is more prominent, the range and relation between projects might be different. The forms of value involved might be more evenly matched. Again, if there are places where the practice of relatedness, including intergenerational relations, has not been subverted by failing authority and the too fluid nature of cash, once again, that would allow variation. It may be possible in such a place to make relatedness itself a principal life project. In a sense, bosses do this by virtue of their resources. Youth are seldom in this circumstance, though, and very few become bosses. It may be parsimonious to say that people who are bored seek conviviality through grog and get caught in its net. On this view, substance abuse is simply illness. That's not my view. Very high incidence of substance abuse correlates with marginalisation or marked disadvantage. Moreover, there is evidence that Indigenous peoples, over and above the poor and marginalised, experience an excess of sickness and death, preventable death. In sum, I draw a causal line between the types of value conflict that I've described, and I've used the notion of ontology to stress their depth, marginalisation, failing life projects, and social suffering as a result. If this account is correct, then federal government block grants, including CDEP in their past, present, and likely future form, need to be considered not simply as governance, but also as schemes that bear on individual projects. To use a hackneyed phrase, CDEP need to be vehicles of meaning for their participants, or at least a source of cash for goods that are part of a system of value. The life projects of consumer or market society can have their location in or outside work, but there needs to be some coherence to the structures attached. Before I go further, I want to signal here that this perspective has implications for field research. It requires ethnographic accounts of how people experience their lives and, if they have it, experience work and other activities. I personally don't think we know a lot about this. To be blunt, I'm proposing that the ethnography of CDEP needs to get out of the office more and into the lived experience of its participants. For the present, I intend to focus on employment itself as the vehicle for meaning. If it has the type of meaning I'm talking about, something that can give some narrative shape to life, then the phenomenon, in my view, is definitely workfare. In order for employment to be workfare, be it CDEP or otherwise, it needs to fulfil three minimal criteria. It needs to have some continuity. Doesn't mean people can't switch around, but there needs to be some continuity in the range of activities. Second, it needs to have some continuity with at least some measures of achievement. And finally, to be a site of sociality that helps make a person at home in the world. By the latter, I do not mean that the workplace should be the be-all and end-all of life. It should, however, at least give a person a sense of where they are in life, generating activity or income for a plausible purpose. When employment is welfare as opposed to workfare, it only fulfils the first of these criteria. It is simply continuous but lacks meaning. A person may just as well sit down and be provided with cash. Workfare, or work as project, is the issue I wish to consider. I'm going to summarise now. I have a section where I point out that, a la Will Sanders, my point is not work for the dole, work versus CDP. So my point is not about how the policy is written, and neither is it Noel Pearson's responsibility, because what I'm actually talking about is context, social cultural context and capacities. I'm talking about what it is for a practice to be meaningful in a particular circumstance. Let me begin with a story. One of the early outstations at Andaria, in the vicinity of Ellery Creek, was given to a man called Jack Coulthard, a guest on Western Arundel land. The reason for Jack's outstation was that he was a Luritja lawman of considerable reputation. He was also an experienced stockman from Tempe Downs. Moreover, he was central to the 1975 revival in ceremony that occurred among men from the mission, Western Arundel and others. When the early outstations were established, it was agreed between senior men and the mission staff that they should be run as a dispersed set of domestic economies, with both schooling and some work occurring on country. The mission had been a pastoral lease, and later a major part of the herd would be distributed among the Arundel. At this time, however, the in-situ work was mainly gardening. Gardening had a history at Andaria related to the 1920s drought, the Caprilia pipeline, and William Ungwanaka from Ermankara, or Running Waters. Ungwanaka was a leading evangelist. He was also in charge of the gardens, planted with the vegetables the Arundel lacked during the drought when many had died of scurvy. The impact of pastoralism on the land exacerbated the effects of the drought and broke the nexus between Western Arundel and a foraging economy. The gardens reflected this, and Ungwanaka's standing was high. I also understand that Ungwanika, or his son, a teacher and a Lutheran pastor, received knowledge for Abmankara from Jack Coulthard. Jack's son, Kevin, married into the Ungwanika family and now sees his major role as being a manager for that country. When, as a guest, Jack received his outstation, he, along with some others, was offered a vehicle by DAA. The story that I'm getting to now is that Jack refused the vehicle and instead chose a tractor. He could be seen from time to time driving his tractor into Indaria. Relatives told this story with a great deal of mirth, and yet I felt a touch of ambivalence. Why would a man like Jack do that? Not like the new kind of boss at all. I asked Kevin why his father chose a tractor. He said that his father was a pretty good drinker and knew that the young fellas like himself were pretty good drinkers too. Kevin said that that tractor made us go monja monja, a little bit slowly, and as a consequence, the youth didn't kill themselves. Possibly, Jack's purchase also cut down on demands. A tractor is not a truck, as Fred Myers and the Pintermy might say. I asked about gardening. Kevin said that the tractor was only useful in clearing land for the garden, and subsequently it helped a bit with the track to the mission. People sat on it and drove it around. The initial place where the tractor was used is now no longer an outstation site. Nonetheless, one can wonder about what went through Jack's mind. Keeping young fellas at his place? Thinking about cultivation, perhaps, and what might make it significant. Arundel youth are still keen on graders, buggies and the like. Making a joke on himself because he knew the true status lay elsewhere in ritual. The tractor appears in retrospect as an enigma and also as a site of conflicting value. How to make something ordinary in Jack's view more significant for youth. Fortunately, Jack died before he could ever know the true cost of this conundrum. Now a short history, and now I'll start reading really fast. When the outstation movement began at Indaria, it was assumed that organisation through kin groups on country would take the place of the centralised and fairly authoritarian regime of the mission, where most people had something definite to do, whether or not they liked it very much. With the decentralisation that outstations brought, there was an attempt to generate an expanding number of small domestic economies, gardening, feral animal mustering, and limited pastoralism were the core activities. The intention was to add some import substitution, R&M, repair and maintenance activities, concerned with access roads and basic housing. This involved a limited venture into making fittings at the Chuwampa Outstation Resource Centre, I'll call it TORC. The number of outstations increased to 40 by the mid-1990s. Cash-strapped, TORC had entered CDP in 1989. As the scale of activity grew, the effort to sustain a large number of small domestic economies began to fail. Simultaneously, training programs both at Chuwampa and in Alice Springs increased, but seemed to lead nowhere, even when the STEP scheme was introduced. There is now a successful ranger training scheme at Chuwampa, led by Andrew Schubert, a lay Lutheran Western Arundel speaker married into a Western Arundel family group. Chuwampa, however, is mainly involved in the administration of income, and most R&M is contracted out. There are high levels of income transfer under the rubric of CDP. Many people have escaped quarantining at Indaria, and not a lot of workfare either on homelands or at Indaria itself. Let me point to some crucial issues in this history and then put the story and the history together. Prior to CDP, people on country found it difficult to maintain domestic economies. This was concerned with rhythms of life that I think many of us know about. Gardening didn't work. Cattle, when distributed, became mainly killers. There wasn't much husbandry. And feral mustering was not sufficient in itself to make an economy in most cases. Tourist ventures began and also petered out. Possibly the most successful venture on country was an enduring rehabilitation centre for sniffers and those who were alcohol dependent. Once ATSIC was established and CDP was introduced, activities at Torque, including the metal shop, began to fail. The fittings made at the metal shop were mainly for the houses that Torque was to build. However, as both outstations and federal transfers increased, Chuampa could not keep up with demand. Ultimately, ATSIC insisted that building works be contracted out. This circumstance produced a common development dilemma. Between the desire to build local government's capacity to provide a service and the desire to actually provide the service to end users. As Fukuyama notes, the latter objective almost always wins out because of the incentives facing the donors themselves, in this case, the federal government. This dilemma was made worse by a new dynamic. Highly centralised resources led some outstation heads to place more and more relatives on their CDEP list and thereby justify the request for more houses. A vigorous politics of houses emerged and quite a lot of import substitution ceased, ironically, as a matter of right. The right to have houses, but not life projects, except for family bosses. A further administrative factor exacerbated matters. As the numbers of outstations grew, it became impossible for one CDEP coordinator to maintain continuous contact with the outstations. And as I go on to say, the CDEP coordinator and assistants became service providers using funding from CDEP to let the NT government off the hook, so that in those terms, the capacity to build local country-based enterprise was foundering again by virtue of lack of administrative expertise and so on. In addition to the rehabilitation centre at Njutnuma, at least three projects worked for a time: road grading, the metal shop, and camel mustering. The sites were respectively out on the road, in-house at Torque, and on country. One could add to them the Ranger program now in operation. And I'm not going to discuss Hermannsburg Potters here because it's not strictly part of the outstation homeland system. These projects are important and interesting because they have endured, at least for a while, in context of rapid and disorienting change. They've involved quite different types of work, although they all require skill and therefore measures of achievement. I've described these initiatives previously in Samson's words as slices of the action, sites of performance or enactment with a leader defined by his or her expertise. Each such leader has pulled relatives in, although in my view, it's not the leader's status in a family as much as performance that holds the action together. In a Weberian sense, one might call it charisma, and as a form of authority, generating a continuing and structured milieu with achievement and skills built in, participants are helped to feel at home in the world. In sum, these slices of action are, in fact, workfare, not my welfare. And in my view, they sit midway between located and kin-based life. Located and kin-based life, sorry, and the impersonalism of market society. Possibly this is what Jack Coulthard was looking for when he requested a tractor. He knew that, as a slice of the action, his ritual world would not engage his youth. Pastoralism was also failing. He was casting around for a new form of mundane enactment. His tractor was its symbol, but he also needed systematic practice, not just a thing as a vehicle of meaning. The other cases have been more successful because they offered, at least for a while, a sense of life project in a milieu where most of the time workers' employment doesn't make much sense. Now, this is my last paragraph and it concerns the hybrid economy. I now wish to relate these points to the issue of hybrid economy. In many of the remote regions where Aboriginal people live, just as the limited number of jobs makes block grants a predictable thing, so at one level of description, hybrid economies are predictable too. They seem just plain sensible. My difficulty with the hybrid economy model is that it seems to foreclose on how local remote Indigenous people want to be. It does this by not having a detailed position on education, specifically English literacy and numeracy, as part of its description. Three out of the four sites that I've described involve men with advanced post-primary education and, in one case, post-secondary education. In the context, their authority is charismatic, but it is in fact based on training and considerable skill. Even so, limitations in small business management as much as transport costs undid the CAMEL project. Block grants are good because they can sustain an element of site variation, funding initiatives that work for a region. But people like the Western Oranda need more than intermittent slices of the action that endure for a couple of years. They need a diverse service economy, which includes caring for country, and the option of going away. Western Oranda youth need these things because they need life projects, not just welfare. They also need freedom from alcohol dependence and a fair chance at personal well-being. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane. We have time for some questions from the floor now. Nick.
Well, thank you for that, Diane. I was just wondering about the development of consumer dependency in Hermannsburg. To what extent are welfare incomes now not able to satisfy the level of desire, say, for phones and computers and things like that? Or are people still able to suppress their desire for things to live within that kind of framework?
I don't think that I can give you a definitive answer on that, Nick, but I can make observations on a few types of consumer good. And actually, I can't see Diana here, but I could certainly relate it to the point she was making, because I actually too am interested in objectification, because I think it's consumption that introduces new forms of objectification that will actually be of some assistance in people working out what they want to do about work. And I know that that's your point too. The couple of areas that I think are interesting is, one is cars and the development in the sorts of cars that young men are interested in and for what sorts of purposes. So that, for instance, when I first went to Indaria, there were only two sorts of vehicle that you saw, and one was a four-wheel drive vehicle generally provided by government, and the other one was what's known in Alice Springs as a blackfella car, which was always pretty much always a Ford or a Holden, and you bought it for between $2,000 and $3,000. Now young fellas are buying much flasher cars, but what is also interesting is there's a much higher instance of mature men buying second-hand four-wheel drives for themselves. And when I went there, that was really, really, really quite rare. The other thing that I've been interested in, and if I wasn't now a retired ageing lady, I'd probably go back and do again, is an ethnography of what people do with the interior of their houses. Not so much in terms of furniture, but appliances and what they put on walls. And once again, right at the outset when I went to Indaria, you could see some variation in that. But I think now it's dynamic and more interesting than it was when I first went there. And these are elements to me about using things as objectifications of a different type than was the case in an Indigenous past. What I don't think's changed, and this is also well, maybe it's changed a little, when clothing, which is the big, one of the great assimilations of things to a very relatedness-dominated social milieu. I mean, for the first few years I was in Andaria, we'd always be driving to these big second-hand clothing bulk holding stations on the outskirts of Alice Springs. It has become increasingly common for women to go to places like Kmart, as well as go to those second-hand clothing stores, although I don't think that the clothing issues shifted so much. The other thing I don't know about where women are concerned are things like washing machines. I mean, people at Indaria, women use washing machines and they get broken. People use fridges and they get broken. But I don't have a genealogy for those white goods. But in other words, I think that there is movement there, and I made the point in my paper that Jack Coulthard had a thing, but he didn't have a set of practices. But, you know, if Diana was here, I'd like to say to her, it's not that I don't think things and material culture are important, simply because of Danny Miller's point that they're modes of objectification. And I think that there's a great project for someone to do out there looking at this and how things have moved over time. That's a long answer, but it's something I'm interested in.
Just a quick question on the or an observation from Unabella about what the people there were wanting. As part of our project, we just sat down with the women and said, well, what would you really like in your homes, besides the second-hand clothes that were obviously more readily obtainable? And they were coming up with suggestions like the sheets, the curtains, the pictures. So the Greek islands on hanging on their wall with with their art, why would they need this? But, you know, obviously the media has a huge role in this. Vases, kitchen utensils. So we ended up with quite a big list.
Yeah.
And we try to satisfy that.
Just two quick observations. I can't comment on the last, say, last 2 years, but I thought Nuradura supplied white goods, the fridges and those regularly through the mining royalties. And the other thing that I found really interesting over 9 years in Alice Springs, that Kmart's products actually have started to be the kinds of things that Aboriginal people want, particularly in terms of women. And I'm talking about black petticoats, which you can't buy anywhere else in Australia. You can buy in Kmart in Alice Springs.
I love
so
that,
there's
Alison.
Obviously a you know, someone in there is looking out for what's needed.
Di, this is very interesting, and and your paper is similar to some other issues that have been raised in this conference, and I think I'm groping for the right term for it, but maybe it's the ontology of indigeneity, that what you seem to be raising there, I think, or at least cuts across that issue, in the 21st century, what is the ontology of indigeneity, and to what extent can we employ Western social theory concepts to analyse these kinds of contexts, you know, terms like practices and life projects and moral careers and so on, charisma. And so that raised for me the issue about the applicability, perhaps, of the theory of social capital and communality, how these are created, recreated, how they cut across each other, and whether I wonder whether you think those kinds of theorisations may also be of relevance here.
Where social capital is concerned, I mean, obviously I'm heading a little bit in that sort of direction, but I have an awkwardness about social capital because, of course, it stems as a term from Bourdieu's diversification of the concept of capital, and of course education as the people in this room mainly would understand it, is one of the prime examples of cultural capital, I guess. My reservation is that here are people coming sideways I use the term market society to describe the sort of sociality that a capitalist system produces in late modernism. But here are people coming sideways to engage with this thing. And I think it's a struggle to think about what types of terms you choose to analyse it, so that you don't have all those parameters of capitalism that all we people or most of us here have lived with for generation after generation. You don't end up with a term that predetermines how you start treating that phenomenon in analysis, where literate education fits in and so on. It might need quite a lot of observation. But the dialogue between the standard term and what you feel you come up with in the empirical process is, I think, what's interesting and productive.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.